No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Together with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So call in and be part of the discussion at 888-627-6008. Or we have a new thing this week, brand new. You can go onto our page, our webpage, at Shadow Politics at BBS Radio. And there's a shadow box that you can type questions into. We'll get them and we'll respond as best we can. Since it's new, it may be a little rough at first, but we think it'll be a great addition to the show. We have some very interesting guests tonight, but first let me say hello to my co-host Maria and tell you, Maria, that we've replaced the squeaky chair, and so it's a red letter day for us on Shadow Politics. How are you?
Good. And you were, was it considered an essential errand that you had to replace the chair?
I walked all around the house and tried every chair that swiveled, because I need to swivel, and finally found one that didn't squeak. So we moved it into position, and we're now in a non-squeaking
vehicle.
Chair.
Oh, so you just repurposed something within the household. Because I thought WD-40 might do the trick, but I didn't want to say.
You know what? We tried that, but it was a really old chair. And at first, because WD-40 didn't work, we weren't sure if it was me that was squeaking or the chair that was squeaking. So, because we're both pretty old. So, but now we've replaced it and we're good. We don't need a WD-40. We have some important guests on our show today. A few weeks ago, Marie and I were very proud to have Dr. Crossland on the show to talk about how the coronavirus was affecting homeless people. Nobody else was talking about this at the time. Now everybody's talking about it. We knew it was a population that was at risk and had been overlooked. And today we're going to talk about another population that's highly at risk and who have been, to a certain extent, overlooked, although they're getting more attention now. And that's people that are incarcerated. And we're lucky enough tonight to have with us Ed Bales and Sean Francis. Ed was the founder of Justice Solutions of America, and Sean is the president of Justice Solution, and Sean is also a former inmate. So we can't wait to hear what they have to say about this important issue, because as you know, I don't know, these guys will tell us, but you can't get much closer than you can get when you're in a jail. So welcome to the show, gentlemen. Thanks so much for being on. And let me start with the first question, which is, tell us what Justice Solutions is and what you do.
Okay, of course, it's a pleasure being on with both you and Maria. My name is Ed Bales, and I'm the founder and CEO of Justice Solutions of America, Incorporated. I started this business with my sister some 25 years ago. And back then, the original company was called Federal Prison Consultants, and Federal Prison Consultants is our flagship division. Since then, it's evolved into state matters, it's evolved into media matters, things of that type. But we're a full-service company, which is different from most companies where people call in and say, well, I'm going to go into federal prison, or I'm going to go into state prison, what can you tell me about it, what's it like? And we're not, that's one of our features. but it's a small scale feature in comparison to what we do. We work with attorneys, we work with politicians, we work with family members, we work with many areas that are outside of just what's prison life, because there's a lot of people out there. Since I started this field back in the 1990s, most people didn't know so much about it. So what we do is we see a person when they come in through either chat or through phone calls or through their attorney, criminal defense attorneys. We deal with many across the country. And what we do is we strategize with them and their attorney whether they're at the stage of indictment, at the stage of sentencing, at the stage of pre-sentencing, any area that they're at, and we can help them. Many people call into us, unfortunately, after their sentence, which then limits possibilities of what we can do. But if someone contacts us before their sentence, we will go over all of the programs and guidelines and rules, policies of both the federal prison system or the state prison system, and even including county jails. We have about 20 people on staff that get involved with matters that deal with the county, the state, the federal system. And most of those people are retired prison officials. We have, for instance, in New York, our New York Prison Consultants Division, we have Pete Curcio. He ran Rikers Island for 23 years. He was the second in command of the New York City prison system. In state facilities, we have some directors, some past directors on staff. In the federal system, we have some former wardens, designation center heads, people who founded the designation center were on staff, which is something that happened over 10 years ago where they used to designate people in a regional level for the Federal Bureau of Prisons, and now they designate them at a designation center in Grand Prairie, Texas. We actually had a very good friend of mine who is a former warden and who ran the designation center, who set it up. Her name is Becky Temez. For instance, she was on staff until, I'd say, in the last year. She retired and some other things. So we have a lot of different people, and my motto has always been, you can't do everything alone. You have to have a mix of people. You have to have people who have paralegal experience. For instance, my father was an attorney in Pennsylvania, and I come back from, 1983 when I worked in his law offices, and I became eventually the practice administrator until he passed away in 1994. So there's people, in the paralegal field. There's people in the mental health and medical field that are involved. There are former inmates that are involved, as well as there are retired and former prison staff that are involved. And I think it takes a team of people to get this correct. You can't just be an inmate who was in prison for 6 months, 8 months, 12 months in one specific facility and come out and you open your door and be a full-service prison consulting company, which is what we are. And that's what 9.5 out of 10 companies are. We are a full-service company. We have a whole staff of people.
Well, let me ask you.
Wait, before we get off the topic, if you don't mind. Ed, what was the genesis that got you to found this company back in the day with your sister? Was there a particular person, a case, something?
But yes, actually, it was myself. I actually spent 4 years in Lewisburg Federal Prison Camp. And the reason that most people don't know that is because my situation goes back to 1989, 1990. And there was no internet then to be able to tell all that. I spent 4 years in a federal prison camp for a white-collar crime. When I got there, I had a lot of legal experience. I was, was my father's practice administrator. And I saw all the things that were going wrong. I saw how inmates were not getting help for not getting into drug programs and not getting into, back then they had the federal boot camp. And I was in Lewisburg camp, and the boot camp for half the country was across the street, and no inmate from that complex could get in. No inmate from our complex could get in the boot camp. Why? Because the camp administrator of the camp and the camp administrator of the boot camp didn't like each other. So he never accepted an inmate into the boot camp. What I did was every 2 years, senators come down and visit the camp. It was one that was very well visited. It was pretty new. It was built in like the 1990 area. I was there in 1995. And I stopped the senators, and I said, this is what's going on. You know, I help people while I'm here. This is what I do. And lo and behold, not long after that, they start accepting inmates into the boot camp. So that's how I started. I started sending motions into judges when I listened to hundreds and hundreds of inmates, because my camp was a camp where everybody came first before they went into the boot camp from half of the country, from the East Coast over to the middle of the country. At the other point was Lompoc, which was a prison camp there, and there was a boot camp there, which serviced from the middle of the country over to the West Coast. So I had all these people coming in, and not only for the boot camp, and they'd get thrown out of the boot camp. They couldn't make it. It was a very rigorous program. I actually thought it was a very good program, but that's how I started, and I started helping people get recommendations and motions from the courts from a pro se standpoint to drug programs and to rehabilitative programs to get transferred closer to the family. And I always say to everyone that comes on staff, especially if it's someone who's retired from the Bureau of Prisons, you may not always like what someone does, but they have family members, and their family members should be entitled to visit them and see them. You know, so that's how I got started in this process, and we actually opened full services back in 1999. My sister headed the company. She did so for several years because everyone laughed when I said I was going to open up this company. I was the person that opened up a full service company that handled matters like this, because I had an attorney that was the Attorney General of Pennsylvania and the District Attorney of Philadelphia who didn't know anything about the prison system, didn't know anything about the federal prison system. I was in my 20s at the time. And I was told, oh, you're too old for boot camp. You're going to turn 30 soon. Wasn't true. It wasn't asked if I had any. I didn't have any drug use or alcohol use or anything like that. But a lot of people go in today and have those conditions and hide them because they think it's going to make them look bad. And the attorneys, even today, prominent attorneys that I work with all across the country, still don't get it right unless they've worked with us and how to help people going into prison. And so that's what my passion is and was at the time.
Well, let me tell you, first of all, I used to work for Jimmy Carter, and we probably have mutual friends, Ed, because several of them ended up in Lewisburg. It's a place I'm familiar with. But let me ask Sean, or you, actually, since you've been in federal prison, and in the District of Columbia, we have no state prison system. Every serious offender goes into federal prison, every felony offender that's convicted. What is the problem that we face right now with coronavirus? I think all of us have an assumption that prisons are crowded and that makes them dangerous. But can you give us some sense of what it's like in a prison and why it's so important that we do something to intervene now to keep incarcerated people safe?
Yes, I'll start off with it, and I'll make a few points, and then I'll turn it over to Sean. He has more experience through across the prisons. I spent my time in a federal prison camp only. I can say this. It was so long ago. It was almost 25, 30 years ago that things happened with me, that back then, Washington, D.C. inmates had their own prison system then. They were not federal inmates when I first went into the system.
Right.
Of course, that changed while I was there, and it made a good impact as far as how they were treated once they became federal inmates, for lack of better words. So in any case, I don't think a whole lot has changed in 30 years for me. The only thing that I see that's major change is there's no boot camp, and there hasn't been any boot camp for 15 years or so. Pretty much everything, and Sean and I talked about this before the conversation, that medical care back then is very similar to medical care now. You have physician's assistants who come from foreign countries that may have been prior doctors in third world countries that assist you, and you have to be almost dead to get to a real physician. So things haven't changed there. I just got an email, and Sean and I were going over that before the show. I just got an email a couple days ago from one of our clients who's in a federal prison camp, and what he said to us from his wife was that there were still 400 people going to have breakfast and lunch and dinner together There's no soap. There's no sanitizers. Everyone's crunched in together. They're not observing the policies that they put out. So it's really bad in the prison systems. And when I looked at the BOP's website today before the show, you know, and I looked at it and I saw, wow, they only have like 170 or 80 cases of inmates with tested positive for the coronavirus, only about 80 tested positive staff members. Well, that just can't be. And we're going to find out more to come. And I'm hoping that some of the new incentives that the Attorney General put out, such as the CARES Act, which is something we'd like to talk about at a latter point in this conversation. So sure. That's what's going on. Not much has changed for me. And I'm going to turn it over to Sean to talk about his situation and more latter day areas of this.
Thank you, Ed. Good evening, Senator. Thank you so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate
it. Yeah, Sean, thank you.
Thank you. And so for my history, just to give your listeners a little background on me, I spent close to 11 years in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, my last term of incarceration ending in 2012. I was in every security level except the camp. So I was in low, mostly medium, and high security prisons. And I, as I'm looking at the Bureau of Prisons websites now, I can tell you that I have been to four of the institutions that are currently struggling to contain the coronavirus cases where inmates have tested positive. So I'm very intimately familiar with those. As far as how things have changed, I agree completely with Ed. Not much has changed. And in my experience in the Bureau, not much does change. And if it does, it comes at a very, very slow pace. When I was there, and this is just a story that I personally experienced, which gives me great concern about the coronavirus and the BOP's response. I was in a federal prison in North Carolina, and I had contracted, like many inmates on the compound, scabies. And if you're familiar with scabies, you know it's highly contagious. The staff refused to treat us, and they even went so far to tell us that it was a mass hysteria, and it was in our head. They only took it serious when the officers started taking this scabies home to their families. So I am very concerned about the quality of care, the ability of the Bureau of Prisons to respond to a life-threatening emergency that is compromising their institutions. And from what I have seen and experienced, and from what I'm reading in the news, I don't believe that they are prepared in the least, and it's very, very frightening. But that is a little bit of background on me, and in my experience, and from what I have seen, nothing has changed since I've been there.
Well, you know, I certainly, I don't know a lot about this issue, Sean, and it's one of the reasons we had you guys on the show, but it's always seemed to me that the way we run our prisons is we lock people away and we want to forget them. I mean, that seems pretty obvious to me, and I think you're right. I think this makes it a very, very dangerous situation that we have these people in control of so many. I don't know how many inmates. You could probably tell me nationwide, but this is a large population, and, you know, the thing that is going on now in Washington, which I mentioned briefly to Ed at the beginning of the show before we got on the air, is that lots of people are suing here in Washington. There was a lawsuit filed Thursday where they want to clear out halfway houses in the district, which are overcrowded. They have one facility, one halfway house, a larger one, where they have 22 people that have tested positive for the virus. So what do you think of these lawsuits, guys? Is this the way we should be going?
Ed, did you want to start with that one, or did you want me to take it?
You can take that, Sean.
All right. And, Senator, just to answer you, you're right. There are 177,000 federal inmates spread across 122 federal prisons throughout our nation. It makes it the largest prison system in the world. And I can tell you, sir, that those institutions, for the most part, there's not empty beds. They are filled to capacity and then some. I have seen auditoriums. I have seen gymnasiums turned into makeshift dorms because there's just not enough bed space for the inmates. So these are inmates who are living in extremely close confines, extremely close quarters. They don't have the ability to social distance like all of us do. They're literally trapped, for lack of a better term, in a petri dish, and they have absolutely no control over what's about to happen to them. So with the halfway houses that you mentioned, Senator, I can tell you that there is a bit of good news. And that is what Ed was talking about earlier with the CARES Act. And one very important aspect of the CARES Act is that now Attorney General Barr has directed the Bureau of Prisons. He's given them home confinement authority. So the CARES Act has allowed the Attorney General to declare an emergency in the Bureau of Prisons. And now halfway house or home confinement can be offered indefinitely, even if U.S. probation and the Bureau of Prisons don't have the ability to monitor those inmates. Now, it used to be the most home confinement that you could get was the last 10% of your sentence, up to 6 months. That's it. That is now, with the CARES Act, gone in response to the COVID-19 crisis. So I think that that is a huge, huge feather in the Bureau of Prisons cap. That's a big tool to start emptying out nonviolent, low-level offenders who don't really need to be there. And to date, after Attorney General Barr's March 26th memo, over 500 have been released. We're hoping to see even more being released because, as I'm sure you know, the vast majority of federal offenders, they're drug offenders, they're nonviolent offenders, they're white-collar offenders. So there is a large population in the BOP where this really should be utilized. But at this point, they are not limiting it to halfway house. The Attorney General has made it clear he has the authority through the CARES Act to send offenders home even if they can't be monitored. So that's huge. And I really hope that the Bureau of Prisons will start utilizing that more.
And so, Sean, wait, as a follow-up on that, Sean, when you were talking about them being warehoused like in gymnasiums or auditoriums and all, this phase five, which went into effect on April 1st, said that they're supposed to stay in their cells and not go into the general population. Does that mean their meals are being delivered to them? And what happens to those that are in communal situations?
Yes, ma'am. So what that means is they have stopped all inmate movement. So generally on a prison compound, every 10 minutes, the inmates are allowed to move from point A. They'll go to their various job assignments. They'll go to educational assignments, visitation. Life will go on, medical appointments, things of that nature. They are now, from what I understand, locked down into their cells. My understanding is that they are actually locked in their cells. They're not allowed out in the housing units. They're on complete quarantine.
For 14 days.
Yes, ma'am, for 14 days. And they're being fed in their cells, bag lunches. It's very, very similar to what happens if there's a major fight or an assault on the compound. They lock the entire institution down, and you're on isolation, and you're simply locked into your cell because there is a sink, there is a toilet, and they let you out probably 2 to 3 times a week for a shower. But you are locked in there with another person. Remember, federal inmates, for the most part, there's a few situations where they are. For the most part, federal inmates are not single-cell inmates. And there are many institutions.
Think about that.
And there are many institutions, like especially when you get into the lower security levels. There's a few in the mediums, but especially in the low, where it is dormitory style. So they don't have the ability to say, we're going to take one or two of you and place you into a cell. They're literally in a communal living situation. That's the way the prison is set up. There's no way for them to space that out. Now, I have heard in FCI Oakdale, Louisiana, which is a medium security institution in Louisiana, where there's been 7 deaths. So it's the biggest institution, biggest number of deaths so far, that they are moving the inmates to the recreation yard and putting up tent cities. And they are bringing in people to sanitize the housing units. Now, there's a lot of room on those recreation yards. And these prisons, generally, mediums hold anywhere from 600 to 1,100 inmates. So I think that's a very smart move because with all of that space there, you're able to distance the inmates. You're able to spread the inmates out. So I applaud them for what they're doing at Oakdale. But on the whole, as I said, 122 institutions, we're talking about one because they have the highest death count. So these inmates are in close confines, and even locking them down, I mean, you're preventing them from walking across the compound, but they're still in a cell or in a communal living situation. And let's also remember, the inmates aren't introducing this into the prison. The staff members are bringing this into the prison. So what are we doing to screen the staff? I have a wife. My wife is a nurse. Every time my wife goes into work to fight on the front lines, she has her temperature taken. She has to answer questions to make sure that she's fit to come to work. What steps is the Bureau of Prisons taking to ensure that their staff is not bringing this into the institutions? And I don't know of any information that suggests that the BOP has instituted any kind of guidelines for staff coming into the prison. Ed, what do you think?
That's crazy. And then if they're asymptomatic, they're still in danger of contamination.
And quick, Sean, just answer this question for me. Does the CARE Act only apply to federal prisons? Because I know that state laws vary. We send our convicted felons to places in Texas and California and all sorts of other places. And I know they much rather go to California than to go to Texas. So since things change from state to state, does the CARE Act protect people beyond the federal prison system?
Go ahead, Sean.
I was going to say no, Senator, it does not. The CARE Act is a federal legislation, and it gives the Attorney General of the United States the power to impact federal prisons. We are seeing a lot of states start taking unilateral action. I live in California. Governor Newsom has released 3,500 offenders in New York, another hotspot. Governor Cuomo has ordered the release of 1,100 parole violators, Mayor de Blasio in New York City, 300 inmates out of Rikers Island. But the CARE Act is going to apply to federal offenders, and then it's going to be up to the local governments on a local level to determine what they do with the state offenders.
Yeah.
So we have a question, Michael, on the chat line. Sharon asked, can Ed or Sean name some of your high-profile clients?
This is Ed. We can't do that. We'd love to say over the years I've handled many, many high-profile clients, and I've been in the media for many years with it. But it's a confidentiality issue, and it's a conflict of interest and many other things. What I can tell you this is to expand on some of the things that Sean mentioned is, and one of the questions the senator asked in the beginning of that section was that there are about 2 million inmates across the country, federal, state, and county. Counties and states have been early on this matter and have reduced and released and limited situations where inmates have to go into prison or self-surrender or even be charged with crimes. But from a federal standpoint, and I must say this too, we're not here to bash the Bureau of Prisons. We work very closely with them. I have a lot of friends that have worked there for years, wardens and things of that sort. We work very heavily with them, and that's one of the reasons that we've become successful, because we understand that they are good people in every setting. There are good people in the Bureau of Prisons staff, and they're bad people. There are good inmates, and there are bad inmates, and so on and so forth across the world. The issue is now is that when it comes to the CARE Act, the CARES Act, there's a protocol that's required, and unfortunately, it's not a short protocol. The CARES Act gives the way federal inmates have to attack this is they have to apply for what is called a compassionate release. Now, we're probably one of the only companies, if you look it up online and you go to our website, you will actually see a video from one of our clients where we got a compassionate release approved. 94% of compassionate releases are denied. I've had several approved with the Federal Bureau of Prisons in my career. I've had several approved in state systems as well. So in order to, you have to file for compassionate release with the prison system. The BOP medical director is where the targeted area of where they go, but ultimately the director of the prison system grants or denies them. The new guidelines under the CARES Act state that when you file compassionate release, if the Bureau of Prisons answers your compassionate release within 30 days and they deny it, then you only have one other choice, which is you have to file what they call the administrative remedy process. That process takes up to 6 months to complete. That's part of our strategy. Even though I say to clients, if you get denied and if you apply for the administrative remedy process, you can't go into the courts until you've exhausted the administrative remedy process. Is it going to help everybody now? No, it's going to take the reverse effect. But if this virus comes back again in the fall, if this virus mutates more, then the inmates of NAMP have to submit and have to do a compassionate release action. And if that action is denied in 30 days, they need to start the BOP administrative remedy process. We have successfully gotten our compassionate releases granted in most of the cases without filing the administrative remedy process. That's extremely, extremely important. So taking that into effect, outside of that, if the BOP takes longer than 30 days to answer, it may be a situation where you can go into the courts with faster action. We're currently working with many attorneys that aren't experienced in BOP policy, and that's what happens. The attorneys come to us and say, what do we do here? We have some very prominent attorneys across the country that come to us. And, of course, we have inmates. We have families of inmates. We have all kinds of people come through us through different channels, mostly through our federalprisonconsultants.com website. That's where you start. And you schedule a consultation with myself and Sean, and that's how we start the process with these matters. But, yes, over the years, we've dealt with senators and senators' children and, you know, all these types of people going into the system. It affects everyone. And one of the things I have that I do with staff, when I have someone come on board, I won't mention this warden's name, a retired warden, but I had a retired warden I dealt with for years as an inmate in correspondence for other inmates. And when she and I spoke, she said to me, Ed, I want to come on staff. I retired. I said, great. She said, I'm going to tell you why I'm going to be good, because I'm a federal warden, or just retired federal warden. I have one brother who went to state prison and one brother who went to federal prison. And without me, he would have never gotten into the RDAP program, which takes time off of an inmate sentence. And that's the type of people I look for, because if you have experience in having this happen to you or a family member, you look at things differently. And to me, that's very important. And that's one of the considerations I take when I bring people on staff, is that they have to respect that a day in prison is a day in prison that's like a year to some people, no matter what their sentences are. So that's how we take it. So we have sentences of people that we've had low as 6 weeks or 30 days for federal prison sentences, up to many, many years. The majority of our people are usually first-time nonviolent offenders. That's our bread-and-butter client, but we've handled every case you can imagine. Now, one thing to state is about the CARES Act. The CARES Act does not allow sexual offenders in federal prison to be released. So anyone with a sexual offense from the minor level of even just looking at pictures may not be able to go out on any type of compassionate release or anything of the like. So that's something to keep in track.
Well, let me ask this of Sean. We have an interesting case here. I find this interesting. We have a guy named Kamal Dorchi, who is in prison awaiting trial. Now, he hasn't been convicted of any crime, but of course, there's no bail, I guess. He didn't make bail, or they're holding him without bail. So he hasn't been convicted of anything yet. And obviously, he's not going to trial anytime soon because the courts in D.C. are closed down. And he was actually quoted in the Washington Post saying it's like a ticking time bomb in here. Each day, the inmates in general are a little more agitated. We are all a little scared. But this is an interesting situation. This guy is in there for being charged with human trafficking. So what do we do about guys like this? He hasn't actually been convicted of anything, but he's being charged with a pretty serious crime. And I would imagine that you would get a lot of pushback from people on the outside about releasing a guy like this. What do you do with a guy like this? Sean, yes. What do you think?
Well, Senator, I think that just because we have a COVID-19 pandemic, and I think just because somebody has a ugly charge, shall we say, the last time I checked, the Constitution still says innocent until proven guilty. And it says we have a right to due process. And if we start suspending due process now, Senator, how scary and how easy is it for us to suspend it down the line for, I don't know, maybe another emergency? I mean, we cannot whittle away at our core constitutional protections because we're in the grips of a pandemic. Now, the Bail Reform Act that was passed, I believe it was in the 80s, made it very, very hard for federal offenders to get bail. And it made it, you know, basically if the U.S. attorney says that he's a threat and the judge finds that he's a threat, they're holding everybody without bail. The vast majority of federal offenders, and not just guys who are charged with human trafficking, guys who are charged with a probation violation, right? They didn't even commit a crime. Nobody gets bail. The only people who get bail in the federal system, for the most part, are truly white-collar, nonviolent offenders. If you're charged with anything other than that, it's a very, very heavy lift to get bail. And that's rather crazy if you think about it, because go to any other state, murderers get bail. They may not be able to make bail, but they get it. So to take and warehouse all federal offenders and say no bail, especially during this time, and then to say you're going to sit in jail, we'll get to you when we get to you. There is no more right to a speedy trial. You can't see your lawyer right now, right, because visitation is canceled. That is terrifying from a civil liberties and a constitutional standpoint for somebody like myself who has been in the system, sir. And I can tell you further, prison and jail is always a tense place, okay? If you're in jail and prison, you don't know what your fate is, right? What am I going to get sentenced to? My family on the outside? Am I going to get stabbed going to the shower? There are a lot of unknown variables in a prison and a jail. But when you...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say,
since you brought up the Sixth Amendment, is there a possibility, I don't know what your legal background is, but is there a possibility that some of these people could walk because they have a right constitutionally to a speedy trial, which we are now unable to give them through no fault of their own? Is that, you think that's a ground for dismissal of charges in cases?
I think it's certainly a ground that could be pled. My background, sir, is that I have a paralegal. Once I returned home from prison, I decided that I wanted to educate myself and become an advocate and turn my life around. I got a paralegal certificate, a bachelor's degree, and I just graduated with my master's degree, all in legal
studies.
Nice.
Congratulations.
Nice.
Thank you so much.
That's so fabulous. Good for you.
So you think that some of these cases, I mean, I would think if I was a defense attorney, I would think that, you know, I would be in there arguing, hey, look, my client had nothing to do with the coronavirus, and he had nothing to do with closing down the courts, and his constitutional right to a speedy trial has been violated.
I absolutely agree with you, Senator. Is it a ground? It sure is. Whether or not the federal courts will grant it, I don't know. I've seen some pretty egregious actions taken by the federal government. I'm just going to give you a quick example. When they passed the Adam Walsh Act, they allowed for federal civil commitment, and I personally watched as people who were convicted of sex offenses were detained for years. As the case went up through the Supreme Court, they had no due process, no lawyer, no probable cause hearing, and the government lost the vast majority of those cases. And when it was challenged on constitutional issues, it was upheld by the Fourth Circuit. So I don't know. I have seen the U.S. Attorney's Office and the federal government get away with quite a bit. And is it a ground to challenge? Absolutely. Is it going to be successful? I'm not going to say that it would be. I don't have high hopes that it would be. I do know that the CARE Act also is addressing this, though, so let me touch on that briefly, because they are starting, historically, federal courts want nothing to do with video conference, right? They don't like cameras in the courtrooms, no videos. However, to address these issues, the CARE Act does allow several types of hearings to proceed via video conference, such as detention hearings, initial appearances, and things of that nature. So we are seeing them start to address this very real issue that you're bringing up of constitutional rights. We are seeing that, sir.
Senator, this is Ed.
Yeah, Ed.
I'd like to make a comment that, you know, we're not attorneys. We're prison consultants, and we can't really make comments too far as the law goes. But Sean did a great job touching upon that. And these issues are related to the Department of Justice in the federal system and the state systems as well. They're not really related to what the Bureau of Prisons may do. They have no control under this type of situation or scenario. So the Bureau of Prisons or any prison systems and jail systems, they're mandated by the courts to do what they must do. Although, again, I've seen so many things in my 30-year career of exactly what Sean's talking about, but the prison systems have no control over it, and we really have to leave that to the attorneys to address fully. What I can say to you is, though, that the Bureau of Prisons does have some policies they put into place for screening tools for volunteers, contractors, inmates, staff coming into the facilities. And the problem is the Bureau of Prisons is understaffed. They usually are. Bureau of Prisons has many people that are sick and out because of the coronavirus. So all of these things aren't getting done the way they should. It's just like the regular, the real world to some degree. Just like hospitals, short staff, you know, people sick with the coronavirus. The Bureau of Prisons is working under very tempered times, and they have their hands filled. But I think that we, you know, we need to see that the Attorney General stands behind the CARES Act, that he was given the authority to give federal inmates the ability to go past their 10% date and past the six-month act of the home confinement situation or scenario. We need to be able to get people moved and get them moved quickly. We shouldn't have to file compassionate release actions. They should be working to do it. It protects the inmates and it protects the staff. The staff is in a very bad situation too. They're in a situation where they may have brought some into the prison, but also there were prison, because of the lack of the Office of the President to shortcut this thing in the beginning, there were still many visits of people coming into the prison, people's families and friends coming in and spreading the coronavirus as well. So no one person or agency or person is to blame. I think this is a situation we have to learn from this whole situation so that if something like this ever is to happen again, we have different parameters and we put things in place.
And I would imagine, thank you, it's kind of the culture of the community, because where I live in Southern California, the sheriff and the district attorney have said that they're doing everything they can to expedite early release. And in fact, they're not incarcerating low-level offenders. They're bringing them in, they're citing them, they're doing whatever paperwork-wise, and then they're just sending them back home. So I don't know, are we at the front edge of that because we're in Southern California, or is that kind of the norm throughout the country?
It is the norm now of the country. The states and the counties are doing that much faster than the federal government. Okay, so yes, we've seen about 15 or 20 states who have done exactly that thing, if not more. And Sean's done a little bit more research on that, and I'll let him jump in from there.
Thank you. And let me just add to what Maria just said. How about those states that haven't recognized coronavirus yet? You know, we still have several states out there where there's no, like South Carolina, where there's no social distancing, there's no mandate to stay home. Are they handling these cases differently?
So I can tell you that I have researched this, and there are, like, South Carolina, the only state so far that has not made any changes with respect to their policies right now appears to be Oklahoma. So, and this is a prisonpolicy.org. I was reading about the various states and their responses prior to coming on today. South Carolina has suspended co-pays for their inmates right now. A lot of prisons and jails have inmates do co-pays whenever they're sick. That has been suspended. And they are starting to institute social distancing. But you're right, Senator. It all depends on what state you're at and what their political philosophy is. I, too, am in Southern California. I'm experiencing the same thing that was discussed earlier. The police, unless it's a very serious matter, catch and release, give you a citation, give you a warning, go home.
Right.
Our governor and the CDCR, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, has been very aggressive in attempting to do what they can to release inmates, to stop the jail churn. And what I mean by jail churn is it's a revolving door, right? They bring offenders in, the offenders get bail, they go home, maybe they commit another crime. It's always a revolving door. And they're working very hard. Many municipalities are. I do think California and New York are leading the way because they have the most cases. They tend to be trailblazers in social issues like this. But I do think from everything that I am reading, I do think that there is a real effort across this country to stop that jail churn and to stop people coming into the system so that they can prevent the spread of this virus. And I just wanted to touch on one thing that Ed had said, which is about the real threat that this virus brings to corrections officials. The Federal Bureau of Prisons is chronically overstaffed to the point where staff members have tried to sound the alarm on this. If you go to a medium or high security prison, there's guard towers that ring the perimeter of that prison to make sure that the inmates don't escape. Those guard towers are no longer staffed in most cases because they just don't have the staff to do it. So if you don't have the staff to run your prison on a regular day-to-day basis and you have a pandemic, once again, that's another reason why I am very frightened for anybody who is behind bars during this time. Ed, what do you think?
My thoughts are similar in the same regard. It's a situation where every area of our government has some form of an issue, from current hospital and health care today to prisons and facilities and keeping up with staff. The coronavirus has not made it easy, and so we can't put our blame in the first responders, and those first responders are our correctional officers and case managers and counselors. Yes, they could do as much as they can, but it's more with the authorities that run the institutions that they have to get their act together. They need to be more in sync. And it's a bad situation. And many of them are trying to do what they can, but yet doing what they can is not enough. And I think the only fortunate thing here is this situation, which probably hasn't been in a situation since 1918, where we've had some type of lockdown in the prison system to this degree. And it's all forgotten from 1918. But 2020 is going to linger for quite some time. And I'm hoping that everyone gets their act together when it comes to that.
And do you think this can help in that regard, Ed, will it be a strange externality of this whole thing that we will focus on the situation that you're talking about, where there's a shortage in prisons? Well, you think that'll be more something that comes to the surface as we go through this whole process?
Truthfully, I'm not convinced that it will. I'd like to think positively that it will happen, and that the government and the Department of Justice and the Bureau of Prisons and all those other entities that are similar in nature will learn from this. But I'm not 100% sure that's going to happen, and it's going to be an element of time. Sean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I've actually thought about this a lot, and I do think that there really can be a silver lining with everything that's going on. Our nation has been in need, especially the federal system, of some real criminal justice reform for a long time. And I think that we have the possibility to achieve that here. I mean, let's think about it. This is unprecedented, where the states and the federal governments are saying, for the first time that I can ever remember, we're going to release inmates. They're low-level, they're nonviolent, they don't need to be here. Well, if they're low-level and nonviolent and don't need to be there now, then when all this ends, they still don't need to be there. So this is a golden opportunity for us to strike some criminal justice reform to lower the inmate population in our nation's prisons and to really do something constructive here. And I really hope that we really seize the moment.
That would be beautiful. Yeah. I mean, this is a learning opportunity, right? And get something in force before the fall, if that, you know, they say there may be a resurgence then, and moving forward.
Yes, ma'am. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, gentlemen, but we have a higher incarceration rate than most industrialized nations, do we not?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're starting to run out of time here, so I want to take a moment, one, for you to give, if you have a website that people, you know, can connect with. We had somebody type in named Sharon, ask the question, what can people do to help? So what can people do to help?
Well, right now, unfortunately, what can people do to help? I would say, and Ed, please jump in and correct me if I'm wrong, but I would say bring attention to the matter. If you have a loved one, advocate for them, or get in touch with people like us who can advocate for them, because unfortunately, for offenders who are behind those prison walls, who are behind those fences, they're in complete control of whatever agency has them, whether it's the Bureau of Prisons or the State Department of Corrections, there's very, very little that can be done. So here is my answer. Call your senator. Call your congressman. Call your state representative. Call your governor and let them know how you feel about this. That, you know, be a voice in your government. Take control. Let your elected representatives know this is important to you. These people matter. We care. And this is not okay. And I think that would be a beautiful thing if people can start doing that. Because, as you said when you opened the show, Senator, this is usually a forgotten population.
Yeah.
I think also that, you know, we're here. If we can help, by all means, give our offices a call. Make an appointment with Sean and myself through our staff that answers the phones Monday through Friday. And we'll be glad to give a review of what we think of your loved one and what we could possibly do to help. It's some of it's an unknown variable. Some of it's a very similar variable to what we've used in people who have terminal illnesses. It's a very similar situation is how the Federal Bureau of Prisons is reacting to this. It's very similar to what someone would be doing if they had a terminal illness with less than a year to live. And it's something that we've done many, many times over the years and have been successful at it. I encourage people from the federal standpoint and from the Washington District of Columbia to go to federalprisonconsultants.com. If you're a state person or you have someone in state prison, things of that sort, go to stateprisonadvocates.com. Also, justicesolutionsofamerica.com is our holding website that holds all of our websites in different areas. We have a specialty website for New York. We have a specialty website for Florida, for California, for Texas. We have many specialty websites. But for all the state and county people, they want to go to stateprisonadvocates.com. But our flagship is federalprisonconsultants.com, and that's what's going to be in most of these matters that we've discussed today.
And we put your website out in our e-blasts and other things, and we encourage people to go there and do exactly that. Maria, since we're running out of time, do you have a last question?
I sure
for
do.
Our two guests?
Ed and Sean, how do you get your funding other than your clients? Do you get grants? Do you have a foundation? How do you pay your bills?
We pay our bills from our clients and their families and attorneys. We're a private company, and we do not have or accept grants of any type. We do get some funding from the Criminal Justice Act. We've got some funding from the courts. I am an adjudicated expert in U.S. District Court, U.S. Court of Appeals under the Criminal Justice Act, and I'm also an approved expert with the Federal Defenders Association. So many times the court will pay for those actions, but that is normally not a process that's on a high level. They don't like spending a lot of money for those type of things, but the fact is we are approved to do work and to be funded by the court. However, most of our money, 98% of it, comes from clients, their families, attorneys, things of that sort.
Nice. Thank you.
Well, thank you both, Ed and Sean. Thank you so much for what you're doing and for
and
being
the
our
inspiration,
show.
Though. You walk in the walk. I love that you come about it organically from within. It's really inspiring to me. Thank you.
You're very
and
welcome.
We hope that you guys will come back on the show as things progress. We'll reach out to you again in the future, and we hope you can come back and report to us that things are going better, you know, that we're protecting these people, because we have an obligation to do that. So thanks again very much, and we hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you very much.
All right. And in a closing word, before I let Maria say the very last thing, I want to tell you that I wrote something on the internet this week. I'm flying my flag every day outside my house to let the world know that we're still here. The Brown family's still here. We're still strong. We're still healthy. And we're proud to be an American. So we're flying the American flag. But I encourage people to fly a flag, whatever flag that is. If you want to fly the rainbow flag or the you know, I went to the University of Southern California. And by the way, let me just tell you something, Maria. You guys are always on the cutting edge. I think we should have a new requirement that you can't run for public office unless you're from the state of California. I think that would help us all immensely.
I'm really proud of how California is responding. Yes, and I'm very proud of our governor and his actions. He's such a statesman. And this week, in one of his press conferences, he said, and I really want to reach out to all the women in the world. It's such a difficult job that you do. And I'm a father, and I'm a husband, and we have 4 children, 10 and young in our household, and oh my gosh, it was like he just gave it a personal feel, you know, not just as our legislator and our leader, but he's a dad and a husband too.
Well, we're going to leave you with the song tonight, as if the news this week wasn't sad enough. We lost a guy that went into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame a few years ago, Bill Withers.
Yeah, what a voice,
81
huh?
years old. Yeah, and what a song, what a perfect song. His kind of hallmark song, Lean On Me. What a perfect song for this time. So this goes out to everybody that's incarcerated, whether you're incarcerated because you're trying to be a good citizen and do social distancing, or whether you're in a jail or a prison or a halfway house. This goes out to everybody in America who is now working hard to beat the coronavirus. We'll talk to you. We're not on next week because it's Easter, but we'll talk to you in 2 weeks. Thank you.
And thank you for listening.
Sometimes in our lives, we all have pain. We all have sorrow.
Give the people their right to vote.